session number 12139, rule 7.
General Breeden, rule 7.
Well, I think they were having a good party, but I think behind it all, I believe now that the Germans realized that they were going to lose the war. And this was almost a sort of farewell to victory. However, I was so impressed with this performance that I sent for the pipe major. And as you will realize, I mean, in wartime, the pipers do military jobs like anybody else, except when they're required to go and do some piping. And I said to him, look, you hear what's going on. We can't be left behind like this. Send a couple of pipers up into one of the forward posts and let them play a few tunes to the Germans. And they did this. And there was complete silence from the Germans for the whole time that the pipers played. They played for about 5 or 10 minutes. And at the end of it, a tremendous outburst of cheering and clapping and more tracer and everything up into the sky from the Germans. And I thought to myself, for people who know that they're going to that they are obviously towards the end of this war, what marvelous morale. And then it was after that that we had a very nasty sort of mountainy battle at a place called Monte Spadoro, and well, the Irish Fusiliers got the worst of this one, and they had quite a number of people killed, and the weather was terrible again, mud, rain, snow. I remember one night when we had, in fact, finally captured the top of Monte Spadoro, but we were trying to hold it. And the weather was so ghastly that people invited me to sort of roll up in a blanket and crawl under a bush or something or other. And I said, no, it's too cold. It's far. And I just walked about all night. And I found that much better. I just walked up and down, keeping reasonably warm and able to think. I think I would have probably got wetter and colder if I'd tried to curl up somewhere. That winter in the Apennines was not a pleasant time. And then our next, when we finished with that, we went round to the. First of all, we did a sort of reconnaissance from San Marino to see where the enemy were. And in fact, the enemy had cleared out by that time. And then we went up to the Senio River, which was a river which flowed across the part of the Lombardy Plain and was sort of on the road, you might say, to Bologna. And from there, we sat there for a few weeks. By this time, it was March. Again, I remember that we celebrated St. Patrick's Day in that area. And we held the flood bank, we called it, of the Senio River. Senio River was simply not a very deep river, or a very broad one, but it was enclosed between two flood banks all the way of its system. And so the two flood banks formed, in fact, the sort of trench system of each of the rival sides. And so one side of the river we manned, and the other side of the river the Germans manned. Occasionally they managed to get onto our side and infiltrated a bit, but by and large it was like that. And it got back to being almost a sort of war like First World War, where you had periscopes and things for looking over the top so that you could see what the enemy were doing. And then the enemy would try and shoot your periscope and all that sort of thing. And again, there were raids and there were ambushes and attacks and all that sort of thing. It's quite interesting, but almost back to kind of World War One type of thing, where each side could throw grenades at each other as fast as they liked and as many as they liked. It must have been very like World War One for the space of a few weeks. Well, then there was the final attack across the Lombardy Plain via Argenta. There was a place called the Argenta Gap, which was between a very flooded area and another area where there were quite a lot of rivers and streams, and in the middle was Argenta, with a gap of about 5 miles, which was good, solid going. And for this, we were very lucky. By this time, I was commanding the London Irish again. I got back to command the London Irish after the Rome thing, because the 6th and Enniskilling were disbanded, sadly, after being such a famous battalion in the war. And so after Rome, the 6th Battalion of the Enniskillings were disbanded. The 2nd Battalion of the Enniskillings came into the Irish Brigade from another division to replace it, and I took over command of the 2nd London Irish from John Horsfall. Well, when we pulled out of defending the line of the Senio, we had a very brief little bit of training and practice with the 9th Lancers. And we were very lucky. We were made into one of the first of the infantry battalions to be equipped with armoured personnel carriers. Now, these were a fairly rudimentary form of armoured personnel carrier. They were really priest tanks with the lid off, but they did the job. And they transported each APC could take a whole section of, say, 6 to 8 soldiers, plus a signaller and a driver. And so we had a considerable number of them, 30 or 40 of these armoured personnel carriers. And we were supported by the whole of the 9th Lancers, 3 squadrons of them. So it's a very strong armour infantry force. And our job was to be the sort of leading element in any breakthrough that there was, and indeed that we were to be part of the pursuit force if that came about. We had a marvellous little get-together with the 9th Lancers before this to work out tactics and things. As I say, a very solid force. It would be one squadron with one company of infantry, a very strong solution, as you might say, not watered down very much. And the company and squadron commanders got to know each other at this party, and we worked out signals and things to make to each other, even if the radio didn't work properly. And it was, to my mind, one of the better demonstrations of two different arms of the same service melding and understanding each other and supporting each other in the different ways. As I think I've said before, the tanks to help the infantry when they are being deluged with small arms fire, and the infantry to attack and capture anti-tank guns when the tanks are being bothered by anti-tank fire. And also, of course, the infantry have to try and attack and capture bridges which are being heavily defended and which the tanks have to get across at some stage. So we got on very good terms with them in an astonishingly short space of time. I mean, we had this sort of cocktail party they had for us, and then one or two meetings as well. And then off we went, and the battle was on. And incidentally, I may say that the adjutant of the 9th Lancers was Francis Pym, who later became foreign secretary. And he was a very, very good adjutant and knew exactly what he was doing. He'd done very well in the Western Desert, as well, I understand. But we were all on a very good understanding. And when what we called the Kangaroo Army, because these APCs were known as kangaroos, and when the Kangaroo Army was moving, and you can imagine, we had anything up to about 200 major armored vehicles, including sort of special vehicles which kind of bridged a gap, and other ones which exploded mines. I think they were called flails, and various special armored vehicles for helping us. We had about 200 major armored vehicles in this little alliance of the London Irish and the 9th Lancers. And when our battalion headquarters was moving, my armored personnel carrier and the CO of the 9th Lancers, Jack Price, his name was, we went more or less alongside each other, usually the tank a little bit ahead and us slightly on one flank on the side. And then whenever we wanted to have a little conversation on how do we arrange the battle now, we would draw alongside, and one of us would step to the other vehicle. And usually a voice would appear from under the turret of the tank, and this would be Francis Pym's voice saying, I'm getting together two glasses of Benevento gin to help you make up your minds, colonels. It was that sort of thing which made the battle go and led to really no arguments between us at all. And the thing then proceeded. Of course, that part of the world has a lot of canals and waterways, so that time was taken up in trying to get across a waterway and capturing some small bridge, which then the tanks could get across. And we proceeded gradually northwards, and we got to a point where then the other two battalions in the brigade, which were the London Irish and the second Inniskillings, and the 1st Battalion of the Irish Fusiliers, they staged a very good little battle, actually in the Argenta Gap. This mainly was street fighting. And I think the Lancashire Fusiliers were engaged as well from one of the other battalions in the division. But the idea of this particular thing, of clearing the gap, was that we were then going to be unleashed through it when it was captured. And when it was, they said, OK, reasonably all clear, when I say that, obviously a few shells still landing and a bit of small arms fire going on. One morning early, the whole of this kangaroo army started to debouch through the gap. And it's astonishing how long it takes to try and deploy a force like this. Anyway, on they went, this time the tanks leading, because the country was pretty flat, and the 9th Lancers had a very sensible habit of anything that looked like a farm, which the Germans would be were always inclined to put one or two self-propelled guns in it to knock out tanks. They'd always knock out the farm before they did anything else. And on we went, and this business of the tanks stopping and sort of signaling to the infantry and say, could you capture that next piece of river line for us? Because there's a bridge there which we know has got an anti-tank gun in it, which is firing at us and so forth. And we'd go on doing this, and then the tanks would overrun some of the enemy infantry for us. And it was all sort of give and take. And on we went until we were really overrunning sort of the officers' messes and the medium artillery of the Germans. And we got to the stage where we were getting so confident that we were actually going on at night, complete with the tanks, and that what we did was, at one stage, we had infantry sitting on the top of the tanks at night, and at the first hint of any opposition ahead, then the infantry got off and went along behind. And if they reckoned that there was somebody with a rocket launcher or something around, which is what the Germans did at night, very sensibly, they tried to have rocket launcher people around to ambush tanks at short range. Then our infantry tried to look after the German infantry who were using these rocket launchers. And a whole lot of sort of desultory battles of that sort went on. By this time, we were moving right out of support range, as you might say. But we somehow felt that we were winning so well that no great harm could come of us. However, there were still German tanks around, and even at a later stage, when we were getting towards the River Po, the 9th Lancers managed to sort of shoot three German tanks in a row who'd rushed out of a farm or something like that, having been shooting at us. They didn't get away quick enough. But a little story which is worth noting, because the sort of thing that one would never have done in normal times of peace or anything, was this, that the a stage was reached during that advance when the divisional headquarters sent a message saying, right, London Irish to revert to being an infantry battalion, somebody else is going to do the job, and the 9th Lancers to go back to their own brigade, etc., etc. And this chap, Jack Price, 9th Lancer CO, and I looked at each other unbelievingly. And we said, but they can't do this. We're winning the war for them. I mean, we were both sort of in our middle 20s and naturally probably felt we were far more important than we were. And we looked at each other and we said, right, let's get into a jeep and go up to divisional headquarters and tell the divisional commander what we think, which we did. And he was a terribly nice chap called General Arbuthnot, who was the divisional commander. And we sort of more or less banged on every door and said, we've got to see the divisional commander. And so somebody finally said, well, all right, but it's up to you as to what you want to talk to him about. And we went to his caravan, and we explained, one after another, we said, sir, you don't understand. I mean, we've got the whole war in our hands. We were winning, and we know each other, the 16th, the 9th Lancers and the London Irish. Everything we do, we agree on, and the thing is marvellous. And don't, for God's sake, stop this battle being won. And I mean, at the end of the sort of outburst of both of us for saying this to him, we kind of looked at each other and thought, my God, I suppose we're going to be sacked now. And the divisional commander sort of looked at us quite sort of calmly, and he said, oh yes, is that all you've got to say? And we just finished up by saying, well, sir, all we're asking you is don't separate us and let us continue as we're going, because we really believe, whether you think so or not, that we're doing rather well. And so he just said, well, thank you very much for your views. By the time we got back to a base, we'd got the message that this has been cancelled and we could go on. But that's the sort of thing, you know, that one would simply have never done that in any other circumstances, except that we were really feeling that we were victorious, and that to separate us would spoil the battle. And at the end of that, we got to the Po. We didn't, in fact, the London Irish didn't actually get at that stage to the riverbank. I think the tanks did the last bit. And some of the other tanks, one of the other tank regiments there. And, of course, they found a fair shambles on the banks of the Po, because the bridges had gone, and most of the German army was rounded up there. And that was the end of the war for us.
Could I now ask you about something after the end of the war, something that's caused a great deal of controversy in recent years, about the sending back of the Russians from Austria at the end of the war? Can you tell me what your personal experience of that problem was?
Yes, I was off about 2 or 3 weeks after the end of the war. They made me the AQ, which is the Chief Administrative Staff Officer of 78th Division, the one I'd been with for the previous 2 years or so. And there was a considerable amount of work to be done, because the whole area was full of displaced persons searching for, either trying to get back to their own countries, having been working for the Germans or working for somebody else. And the whole place was the most tremendous melee, plus the fact that, of course, all communications had been broken. There was no coal coming, of course, from the Ruhr or anything to other countries. There was a tremendous problem of building camps for partly displaced persons and partly for prisoners of war in Austria. And there we were in Austria, and we then had, of course, this problem of the Cossack Corps, which had handed themselves over to the British, reckoning that in no circumstances did they wish to be handed over to the Russians. We were trying to administer them. And then the next thing we got was, on my side of the picture, because I wasn't dealing with this. This is on what in the army terms they would have called the G side, which is the operational side. And that was dealt with by the chap who was the G1, and he was the chief operations officer, and, of course, General Arbuthnot. Well, the orders came, I don't know exactly who from, but presumably from the corps commander, that we were to send all these Cossacks, the Cossack Corps, as they called it, back to Russia. And they were already in these various camps. Well, nobody really quite knew the situation. With hindsight, of course, one can see what a fairly unpleasant thing it was to try and do. Because when the Russians, when the Germans had invaded Russia originally in the war, many of the people who they came across in the first bits of their campaign, particularly in the Ukraine, were people who regarded the Germans as lifesavers, that they were rescuing them from the awful rule of communism. And so a lot of them were prepared to fight for the Germans in order to regain their own country. That's about what their sort of feelings were. Well, we didn't know anything about that. All we knew is that here were these people who apparently were Cossacks and were now fighting for the Germans, and that was that. And here were orders that we'd got to return them to the Russians. Vaguely, we thought, is this fair? I mean, after all, they were prisoners of war. We accepted their surrender, and there ought to be more to it than this. But, you know, we only sort of thought vaguely that, not knowing the real background, which we learnt later. Well, the next thing that I got was when these the orders were given, a lot of the camp commandants of these Cossack prisoner of war camps, as you might say, they saw what was going to happen, because when they talked to some of their own prisoners, the prisoners would say, but we shall be shot as soon as we are taken out at the first station in the Russian zone. And a lot of the camp commandants sort of saw that this was probably quite true.